1 year ago yesterday, Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed as a Supreme Court justice by a 50-48 vote in the Senate. In September 2018, the FBI's week-long investigation of the sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, then President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, left millions of Americans feeling unsatisfied, even more questions unanswered. Through fly-on-the-wall reporting and exclusive interviews with classmates and friends and colleagues, New York Times reporters Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly fill in the blanks with a deeply rooted account of the events leading to the explosive confirmation hearing in their new book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh. Robin is a reporter on the New York Times' Culture Desk, where she covers the art world and cultural institutions, exploring the internal politics, finances, and governance of museums, auction houses, galleries, and performing arts organizations. The name of the new book is The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, written with Kate Kelly. Robin, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
What a delight to have you on the program. Correct pronunciation of your last name is?
Pogrebin.
Pogrebin. Okay, good.
Right.
I am fascinated by this book. I learned so much in it, and I'm curious as to how you came about it. I mean, the obvious question that I have is, how does a Culture Desk reporter come upon this particular story?
It's a good question. The way that I got involved is that I actually was in Brett Kavanaugh's class at Yale. I actually lived a few doors down freshman year from him. We were both class of 1987. So when the Times was marshaling its forces to cover the nominations a year ago, I was one of those pulled in, at first because I had the yearbook and access to the Yale alumni directory, and some of our social circles overlapped, so I was able to reach out to classmates when we were trying to flesh him out as a person and get a better sense of his past. Kate Kelly, my colleague, grew up in the D.C. area, which is where Brett Kavanaugh grew up. She went to an all-girls school. He went to an all-boys school. So there was a cohort of kind of single-sex schools that she was part of, although she is 10 years younger than he was.
So did you know the circles, or did you know him?
You know, I knew him to say hello. My college roommates were varsity athletes, and Brett Kavanaugh moved in a social circle of varsity athletes, so there was some overlap socially in terms of people we knew. I did not know him well by any stretch. I wasn't sure that he would remember what I looked like, but I certainly remembered him. He became a famous alumnus at Yale when we would go back to reunions, and some of us were asked to speak on panels. I was on subjects of journalism. He was on subjects of jurisprudence and law. And he was a point of pride for the class of 1987 because he had made it in the big time.
This book came out on September 17th, 2019. In the days leading up to it, there was a huge uproar in the press about the possibility of an impeachment of Brett Kavanaugh. That has now been replaced by an impeachment of the President of the United States. It seems like 300 years ago, and yet it's only been a couple of weeks.
Yes, I think that it speaks to the moment we're living in politically, where, first of all, the news cycle is faster than ever, and, you know, what is explosive one day is old news the next. I have certainly experienced firsthand the notion that the caravan moves on, and it has certainly moved on from Brett Kavanaugh's impeachment to President Trump's impeachment. I think it also speaks to this intensely partisan moment we're living through in terms of how divided this country is politically, how people have chosen sides, and those positions have calcified over time, not loosened in any way. People aren't really necessarily listening to each other. They have their minds made up. That was certainly the case that we found in terms of this Supreme Court nomination, and it's the case now in terms of President Trump's prospects.
You said a moment ago something interesting about at reunions he was a rising star and a star amongst these panels and so forth. And so how much of this, of his being nominated, which was obviously, I mean, in the cards for him for a bit, did you think of, like, how far do you have to dig before you think to yourself, oh, well, this is going to be trouble?
Well, it was interesting to find, actually, in our reporting for this book, was how there was a Republican contingent that actually felt that Brett Kavanaugh was not conservative enough. They were very interested in cementing the conservative, the right-wing tilt of the court. Once Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement, he had been a swing vote, at times a great disappointment to conservatives, and they wanted to secure this 5-4 majority, and I think that Brett Kavanaugh was less of a guarantee of doing that. He is historically been known for his 12 years on the D.C. circuit as a pragmatist, but not a right-wing ideologue by any means. And there were times in which he satisfied conservatives with his decisions. There were times when he disappointed them, as he did with Obamacare and an abortion case involving an undocumented immigrant. So I think it's interesting to note that he was not a sure bet. He wasn't at the top of Trump's list originally in terms of candidates for the court. But he is also an establishment D.C. figure who had a lot of support in the swamp, as they say.
But obviously, when you put a candidate forward, you're going to vet them and look and see what trouble could be lurking. How much, in before, as the nomination was getting ready to be rolled out, how much was known about and how much was concerned about the sexual assault claims?
My sense was that there was a general sense that perhaps a Me Too allegation could surface, but more in connection with Judge Kaczynski, who Justice Kavanaugh had clerked for and had a close relationship in the past, having clerked for him. And then they vetted judges for Justice Kennedy. They wrote a book together. So since Kaczynski was accused of sexual misconduct and ultimately forced to retire from his position, I think there was some feeling that even by guilt by association might rub off on Kavanaugh in a problematic way. There was also concern, frankly, about the documents, which, if you recall, before the Christine Blasey Ford allegation surfaced, that was the main source of dispute between Democrats and Republicans, which was there were all these documents from Kavanaugh's years working for George Bush for two terms, as well as his court decisions, where the Democrats felt as if they hadn't been given access to all of them in their entirety, that the Republicans had given them only a select amount. And that was the main issue of debate when the hearings first kicked off in early September last year.
When you started working on your stories on Brett Kavanaugh, when did you start to, and for this book, of course, when did you start, were you able to be able to interview Christine Blasey Ford, be able to interview Deborah Ramirez, and get a more rounded picture of than certainly what was presented at the hearings as to their experiences as well as their deep grave concerns?
Yes, that was important to us. As you allude to, there was the sense that these people were caricatures. When we experienced this confirmation process a year ago, we wanted to flesh all of them out in a more three-dimensional way, including Christine Blasey Ford, Deborah Ramirez, and Brett Kavanaugh himself. Both Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez are understandably bruised by this experience. On the one hand, they received an outpouring of support by victims and others about having spoken out publicly, ultimately, although neither of them intended to do so initially, and having kind of been brave in doing so in a way that made other people feel emboldened to tell their own stories. On the other hand, there was a lot of ugliness that this brought out in terms of death threats against both of them, particularly Christine Blasey Ford had her life upended. She's had to move her home several times. She has yet to return to teaching. So it's a real mixed bag in terms of what their experience was. But we wanted to also kind of explore this issue of contemporaneous collaboration, which, for better or worse, is what you have to work with in these kind of sexual misconduct allegations. It is a he said, she said situation, often with two people in a room, or Mark Judge in the case of Brett Kavanaugh, according to Christine Blasey Ford, his friend was present. But it is difficult to reconstruct these stories. Typically, there are not eyewitnesses. So you look for people they told at the time, people they told within a few years of it occurring, maybe a diary entry they wrote. We were able to flesh out Deborah Ramirez's story in much greater depth than it had been kind of recounted a year ago.
Of course, the headlines come out of the book are several. One is there was a third woman, Tracy Harmon Joyce. And tell us about her and the allegations made by her.
What's important to note about the Tracy Harmon Joyce example is that She herself has told friends she doesn't remember it. It occurred at a drunken dorm party. The reason we reported it and felt it was meaningful, it is the unusual case of an eyewitness, in this case specifically a classmate named Max Steyer, who now works in Washington, D.C. He runs and founded a good government organization that is sort of visceral, you know, very vigorously nonpartisan, that attempts to kind of encourage government service. And he recalls witnessing Judge Kavanaugh exposing himself to another classmate, Tracy Harmon Joyce, at another drunken dorm party freshman year. It was germane to our story because it echoed Ramirez's experience, which also involved Brett Kavanaugh exposing himself allegedly at another freshman dorm drunken party, but also because Max Steyer brought these allegations to the FBI and several senators, and they were never pursued, which speaks to the process and the degree to which this was a real in-depth effort to find out every fact and make it public.
You were able to speak to Leland Kaiser. This is the friend who Christine Blasey Ford said was present at the party with her. What did you get out and understand from that interview as a result?
What was interesting about the Leland Kaiser story is that, if people recall, Christine Blasey Ford describes Leland Kaiser being the only woman at this small gathering at which this assault allegedly occurred. Both she and Leland assume that Christine Blasey Ford drove her home, although there is not dispositive evidence of that. What we found is that Leland Kaiser initially said she did not remember this incident, but that she believed her friend, Christine Blasey Ford. She subsequently changed that account and said that actually she believes it didn't happen. And what we report in our story is that she doubled down on that skepticism by going back to the FBI a second time after being interviewed and saying, I really don't think this happened. I don't remember Brett Kavanaugh. However, we did find that Christine Blasey Ford was credible for several other reasons, in that there are circumstantial descriptions of that time of year and people that she and Kavanaugh had in common, including the fact that Leland dated Mark Judge, who Christine Blasey Ford also puts in the room at the time. Christine Blasey Ford herself dated Chris Garrett, who was kind of known as Squee when Brett Kavanaugh referred to him in his testimony. So he was a good friend of Brett Kavanaugh, and Christine Blasey Ford dated him. There were also just incidents around that summer that kind of are borne out. And frankly, you look at the credibility of these witnesses, Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez, and whether they have a history of integrity, whether they have a motivation to lie, whether they have a political axe to grind. And so we found in both cases their stories were credible. That said, we did not find in the last 36 years that this is a sexual predator with a pattern of behavior and a trail of women in his wake, that by all accounts, Brett Kavanaugh has either matured or seen the error of his ways and behaved in a more commendable, upstanding way ever since.
Robin Pogrebin is the co-author of the new book, The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, An Investigation, written with her colleague at the New York Times, Kate Kelly, and it's published by Penguin. When it comes to this education, if you will, of Brett Kavanaugh, just talk about that title, because that says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. We thought the title resonated on a lot of levels. On the one hand, most literally, we looked back at his personal development in high school and college, because those are the years when character is arguably formed. You know, what was it like in the fact that he was at a same-sex boys' school? We actually found in talking to high school classmates that there was a culture of casual misogyny, and that somewhat extended to Yale. We're talking about the 80s when there was not this Me Too consciousness in terms of behavior, which clearly we're living in a different time now. But I think that lack of sensitivity is very important in understanding who he was. Also getting a sense that, you know, he wasn't this guy with a lot of moves and a lot of kind of romantic attachments, that he even testified later on national television that he was a virgin through college. So understanding who he was through that educational lens, but also how kind of the country was sort of educated about how toxic this climate has become politically, and that Brett Kavanaugh himself was schooled on. He thought he knew Washington. He thought he knew how to navigate the politics and just the mechanics of a process like this. And I think even he was surprised by how ugly it became.
I'm making this up in my head, but I want to ask you, meaning that I would think in doing something like this, a project like this, you see his testimony, you're reporting on it, you're actively reporting on it. And then as you work on this book project, you talk to a lot of people, you go back, you talk to a lot of people, you go back, you talk to a lot of people, you go back. And then is there a point where you watch that entire testimony and just think, wow. Just think, wow, that is because it's unlike anything we've ever seen in testimony.
It is. And what I found that was most profound, and I think our book reflects, is this kind of Rashomon around this whole experience, right? Where you have people who looked at him and that testimony on September 27th and said, this confirms my suspicion that this is an entitled white male privileged guy who, you know, believes that the fact that he went to Yale Law School should absolve him of any responsibility for perhaps irresponsible behavior when he was young. There are others who say that and I should add that there are those who felt that his testimony and sort of self-righteous indignation and rudeness towards senators like Amy Klobuchar was disqualifying on the face of it. And you had even someone like Justice Paul Stevens say, I supported this guy before. I can't anymore. He can't possibly be impartial on the court. Then there are those who say that if you were falsely accused of something and you're fighting for your personal and professional reputation, wouldn't you be this exercised? And that we should all be able to relate to that sense of fighting for your life. And so we explore both. We ultimately determined it's not our role to say whether Brett Kavanaugh deserved to be appointed to the court. We leave that up to the reader. But we do try to put all the facts out there. And one of them is that even those who know him very well say they've never seen that side of him before. He testified that way.
I think it's good you do not make that call, and yet do you? It has to, going through, and I'm not in any way trying to stoke sympathy for him, but it has to change you in some fundamental way, right? I mean, you were battled, and you certainly. A lot came out about you that most people would not want to have them have come out about them, whether it is true or false. So how does that change you? And in the case of Brett Kavanaugh, does it impact him as a justice on the United States Supreme Court?
It's a great question, and there are those who say that Clarence Thomas was forever changed by his experience with the Anita Hill accusations, and that he has been incredibly embittered ever since, and that his jurisprudence on the court bears that out, and this is a man who will kind of never forget that juggernaut and never forgive. There are others who say that Brett Kavanaugh is a different kind of person. He does speak to this idea of living on the sunrise side of the mountain, which is actually a quote from George Bush, who Brett Kavanaugh worked for two terms in the White House, and who he considers a mentor and a role model, and that is to be the optimist. And I think you definitely see a Brett Kavanaugh who wants to move past this, who would like there not to be an asterisk next to his name, so to speak, in terms of always being remembered for these allegations and for this toxic hearing experience, and to be remembered for his service on the court, which was a life goal for him. And I think he wants to kind of pursue it and live it out honorably. Whether that's possible remains to be seen, because we are living in a time where everything is weaponized. And if he, you know, there's a Louisiana abortion case coming down that the high court agreed to hear on Friday, and that will certainly be a litmus test for both sides of the aisle.
It's interesting because you think of what it's first Monday in October, so the court's back in session, and his first full session. So what does it, or that's not true, this will actually be a second, right? Because he did do a full term?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
so
right.
Second.
He did.
I guess my overall question is what should we make of this? I mean, I think this book helps us of where we are, not only with the Supreme Court, but with confirmations, where we are in the Me Too movement, where we are in trying to figure out who's telling the truth, who's not telling the truth, who is discarded, who isn't, and trying to make sense of all of that.
Yes, and I think all of those are great points that we try to explore in the book. There was a review of our book in the Washington Post that said we had described the messy middle. And I think that's really what we tried to get at here, which is that people saw in these hearings what they wanted to see. They came into this process with their minds made up. And it speaks to this moment in our time where people don't really have open minds. They aren't listening to each other. They're in their corners and sticking to it. And I think hopefully what we'd like is that this is a more nuanced portrayal of everything that went down, as well as the people who populated this dramatic story, that we understand that there is a real kind of human frailty, and these are imperfect people with don't have neat and tidy stories, but they are worth exploring, and it's important to hear from alleged victims of sexual assault. It's also important to go there in your minds to the idea that perhaps Brett Kavanaugh was accused of something he didn't do, and that is a horrific experience in and of itself, and it definitely speaks to the idea that our court is no longer immune from politics. This started with Bork. It continued with Clarence Thomas, with the Merrick Garland being shut out by the Republicans. Kind of nothing is safe from politics now, and it would be nice if we got back to evaluating judges on the merits.
I know it's difficult to speak out against any employer of somebody that signed your paycheck, but did you wince when you saw the tweet about your story that was going to be in the paper?
I mean, what's important to say about, I mean, I think it's unfortunate that, you know, the rollout had these complications at the Times, because it definitely distracted from the hard work we've done on this book and the efforts we've made to have a fair and balanced account. I should say that I need to own responsibility for the tweet, because what we were going for, and I drafted it, was to try to preempt those who make the argument that, you know, pulling down your pants at a drunken dorm party is just kind of harmless fun and boys being boys. That is an argument I've heard and wanted to get out ahead of and say, you know, that may seem that way to you. On the spectrum of sexual misconduct, this is not sexual assault. Nevertheless, it's damaging and unacceptable. The phrasing of it, unfortunately, made it sound like we were saying the opposite. And so we regret that, and we apologized for it at the Times. But again, it speaks to this idea that people seize on what they want to seize on and make political hay of it.
And then there was also the issue, and this is one of the things that I thought was, because, as you say, people look for what they want to look for, but it was it interesting that they had it in the opinion section as an essay as opposed as an excerpt?
The issue with the excerpt is that, you know, you're trying to figure out where's the best home for an excerpt from your book. The Times does not exist to help promote our book in any way. We had to have something that was worth reporting. And what we felt was most revelatory was this kind of fleshing out of the Deborah Ramirez story, which was somewhat sidelined during the initial process a year ago. She never testified publicly, and people kind of dismissed it as piling on by the Democrats. And so we wanted to go back at her story. We also wanted to put it in a cultural context, because she was a woman of color, because she was from a lower middle class background, which informed her experience and why she found this so traumatizing. And we mentioned this new allegation in it, in which we did name the person who Max Dyer allegedly saw Brett Kavanaugh expose himself to. The editor took issue with our naming her, because the Times has a tradition of not naming victims, not necessarily bringing undue attention to them. When he took out that line, we omitted a caveat about the fact that she had told friends she didn't remember it. And once again, Republicans pounced on that as the idea that we were withholding evidence that it was exonerating. So we obviously had no intention to do that, and we put it back in when we realized the error. And there was an editor's note acknowledging it. That's the best we can do.
Robin Pogrebin is the co-author of The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, An Investigation with Kate Kelly. The book is published by Penguin. Robin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.